Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Okay, we are live. Hi, this is William Ramsey. Welcome to William Ramsey Investigates. On today's show, I have a very special guest. His name is Jack Roth. Last name is spelled R-O-T-H. Just published a fascinating book. I read through half of it. Title of the book is Killing Kennedy. Exposing the Plot, the Cover-Up, and the Consequences, just published November 2022. He has a foreword by the great Cyril H. Wecht, who I've interviewed a couple years ago, but it's nice to see him involved in this. And he has, the layout is really something very different. I've done probably at least 10 shows on the Kennedy assassination, different authors, and some of the authors are included in this book, but I learned a lot from this book. There's a lot of names that I wasn't familiar with and a lot of insight. So it's not just in such a, that event was so important and so multifaceted that I think Jack did an excellent job of integrating many of the themes involved in what happened on November 22nd, 1963. So I highly recommend this book. It comes in a paperback and a hardcover, but I'm really glad to have him on the show. So Jack Roth, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, William. I appreciate it.
Awesome. So for people who may not have heard your name, I was listening to some of your other interviews on other podcasts. Can you kind of talk about your background and what led you to putting together this book, Killing Kennedy?
Sure. Well, I'm an author, a documentary filmmaker, and I've been a journalist. That's my background. So I've been a journalist for, I would say, 30 years or so. So, but what got my... I've been interested in the Kennedy assassination since the time I was probably, I don't know, in early teens. I was born in 1965, so I wasn't alive yet when the assassination occurred. But I feel like I grew up and my formative years were the ripple effects of the assassination, right? The counterculture movement, Nixon, Watergate, Vietnam. You know, here I am, this little kid, and I'm like, you know, I remember that. I remember growing up and seeing stuff and hearing stuff. And so, but I think, and again, in 1991, like so many other people, when Oliver Stone came out with JFK, I saw that movie and that inspired me to just do a ton of research, just to read as much as I could. And then years later, I always wanted to do something. I wanted to contribute to what was out there with the research, but I also knew there'd been thousands of books written on this already. And there were researchers who have been doing this for 30, 40, even 50 years, looking into specific things related to the assassination. So what I thought was, well, I'm a journalist. I know I'm good at doing interviews and asking the right questions. So I thought, well, what if I, because what I was talking to some friends about possibly writing a book, and there were certain themes that kept coming up. Ripple effects, why it still matters today, present day relevance, the cost of that type of a conspiracy. So I figured, you know what, let me put together almost like a people's history where I'd interview different people, and ask them specific questions based on their background and based on their expertise, and also ask everyone the same questions, which were basically would have been the ripple effects and why does it still matter today? And the key was getting the right people. I felt like if I could get the right people interviewed, it would be a really compelling read, and that it could be a jumping off point for people who they could read this and then dive into something deeper if they wanted to, based on what they learned from the book. So I was really pleased with the way everything turned out. It's almost like one thing led to another. And I interviewed one person and then, they introduced me to someone else. And again, some people are more familiar to, will be more familiar to readers than others. But the insights that I gained and hopefully the readers will gain, I think is the thing that really surprised me the most. I couldn't believe some of the things I was hearing, and I thought I knew everything.
Well, I learned a lot too. Like some of these people that showed up and some of the connections and so many things happened. It wasn't just the Kennedy death. And I've talked to Mark Shaw about Gilgallon and some of these, what was the other one? Paul Janney of Mary's Mosaic. So there's so many things surrounding Kennedy that you included, and the different perspectives were really fascinating. Can you kind of talk about research and talking to these people and what it was like kind of tracking them down?
Yeah. It was a lot easier than I thought it was going to be. I had help at the beginning from a few people who knew that community, the research community. And once I interviewed a couple people and they realized I was professional, I was doing things the right way. I was respectful. Once that started to get around, then people, you know, one interview led to another. And one of the things I wanted to do with the book is humanize the Kennedy assassination. So what started to happen is each of these interviews was a journey. It was a person's journey. And it became very personal. Like every interview I did, there was at least an element of it being an extremely personal journey. Even if they were researchers and they were coming from a very objective standpoint, they went through a lot over the years of trying to research this. And that story was always fascinating. And then some people just blew my mind. And the level of emotion also really surprised me, that after 60 years, people were so emotionally invested still in the assassination.
Oh, it is fascinating. And a lot of people like felt risk. They felt their life was at risk. It affected their family going down this road. Some people dedicated decades. So it really was an interesting aspect of the book. Some of the names look, I mean, I'm familiar with some of these other people, but you had people that I'm not really familiar with, like David Mantic and Rivera and Palomar. Can you kind of talk about some of those original researchers and what they added to kind of the corpus of understanding what happened?
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Yeah, and that was important to me. I actually interviewed, there are 24 people in the book. I do 24 interviews, but I actually did more. But 24 people made it in because simply it would have been too big of a book. But because again, I kept getting one person after the other, but the researchers were important. And that's why I start the book with the researchers in that section, if you will. They lay the groundwork and they kind of ground everyone from the get-go like this. And each has a particular area of research that they are known for. David Mantic is an MD and he studied the x-rays from the autopsy and has done phenomenal work on analyzing that. And some of the other researchers you mentioned, they're all just fantastic. I mean, they all focus on specific particular things, whether it's what happened to Kennedy's body from Dallas Parkland Hospital to Bethesda Naval Hospital. Okay, let's go down that journey, that rabbit hole. And they've done 10, 20 years of research just on that. So I was able to kind of lay the groundwork early on in the book with these researchers who have dedicated, again, decades of their lives trying to, in their way, determine based on their background and what their interest was, a certain aspect of the assassination that stood out to them. So yeah, that was fun. Those guys were fantastic.
Yeah, I didn't know. I mean, Mantic says that Kennedy was shot 3 times in the head. That to me was remarkable. I'd never heard that before. So you had that kind of base line of the researchers, but also one thing people kind of overlook, maybe it's in the JFK movie or something like that, is the importance of New Orleans. That's where Oswald was from, right? Wasn't he from? And he bounced through New Orleans with all these strange characters. Can you talk about that part of the book?
Yeah. And, you know, listen, in Oliver Stone's film, as we know, JFK, that's the crux of that story of that particular movie is what in and around was going on in New Orleans. And so I always had an interest in, wow, there, you're right. There's a lot of really interesting characters. What I quickly learned is that we know very little. We think we might know what was going on in New Orleans in the summer of 1963, but boy, there was a lot more going on in New Orleans in the summer of 63 that from a intelligence community standpoint was just, you know, as important as it gets. And would also too, in 1963, New Orleans was almost like the Casablanca of U.S. intelligence because of it had the port, its proximity to the Caribbean and South America, Cuba. So that was an important intelligence. It was like a hub of intelligence that was going on there. And they also had a lot of different operations programs going on there. And not all were related, obviously, to Kennedy. They were related to Cuba, or they were related to assassinating Castro. But they were also sheep dipping a man by the name of Lee Harvey Oswald during that time. Oswald's from New Orleans. And so he was there for that period of time. And I learned a great deal about who he was as a person because of the particular people I interviewed that knew him as just a guy, not as a patsy or not as a lone nut assassin, right? But just as a human being. And I thought that insight, that was one of my favorite parts of the book for me, was this whole thing of what in the world was going on in New Orleans in the summer of 63.
It's a very murky city for people who have not been to New Orleans. It's always had that kind of Casablanca feel. There's all kinds of people traveling through there, lots of different ethnicities and trading. It's just very, and it's Crescent City has a reputation for corruption. So there's a lot of strange things that went on. Even then, and there was another death. What was the woman's name who they found her body with their, like...
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Yeah, that was Mary Sherman. But she was a doctor and was a very famous doctor, very established and respected doctor in New Orleans. And she was helping to do some of this cancer research that was going on. But it was funded, part of it was by the CIA. So it was kind of like these black operations, these black projects there that they would use, like, for example, Tulane University had a medical school. And Alton Ochsner, Dr. Alton Ochsner, who was also a famous physician, surgeon, they would use those facilities because Ochsner was a CIA asset. The CIA infiltrated a lot of different institutions, and many of them were educational institutions because they would do research there under different names and whatever the projects they were doing. But in this particular case, Mary Sherman was working on cancer research, but specifically as well, weaponizing cancer for the CIA in an attempt to eliminate Castro and other undesirables to the CIA. So you had the CIA doing all this stuff. And ironically, a lot of these people were the same people that also the names came up during the Kennedy assassination, David Ferry, Clay Shaw, Lee Harvey Oswald, and her murder, which has never been solved, is you have to read the chapter, and the book is called Dr. Mary's Monkey. It's by Ed Haslam. So again, I was able to interview Ed, did an extensive interview with him. He's amazing. Did years and years of research on this, and his conclusions, they'll put gray hair on you. They really will. I mean, it was amazing what they were doing down there.
It's incredible. And I think Shaw was taking Oswald to one of the medical facilities there too. Like, it was just so unusual. They were sheep dipping, right? So he was giving out pamphlets or whatever about fair play for Cuba or whatever. So he might not, but I mean, according to Baker, he was, Lee Harvey Oswald was much more sophisticated than people might think. I mean, he was killed at age 24, but
yeah,
he was more well-rounded maybe than people think. Would you agree?
Without question. Yes. A very intelligent person. You know, a bit introverted, perhaps bookish, but that's all he did was read. And he had dyslexia as a child, and he worked through that, and just was an avid reader. So he was very knowledgeable, and again, was fluent in Russian, which is why, you know, he was part of the false defector program that the CIA was running under William Harvey, was in charge of that. And when Oswald, quote unquote, defected to Russia, that was a false defector program. So that was through the CIA. And that's why when he came back from Russia with a new wife, Marina, they didn't even question him. Like, here's a guy that defected at the height of the Cold War, right after the Cuban Missile Crisis, or I should say before, but during that period of time, late 50s, early 60s, where there was a lot of tension. And here's a guy who, quote unquote, defects to Russia, is there for a couple of years, gets married, and then decides he wants to come back to the United States, and they don't even blink. And that's just not something that would have normally happened if just a person defected to the Soviet Union. It would have been very difficult for them to get back.
If at all.
But Oswald was a loyal intelligence asset.
Do you think that his intelligence work started? He was at Tsugi, right, in Japan. Do you think he was recruited in the Marines or something?
I think so. A lot of people believe that's when it was. He was in the Marines, and he was stationed there. That was all the spy planes. So he learned spycraft while there. And they probably realized, man, this guy's sharp. He's smart. He can handle things. They know who they're getting, and they know who they want to recruit. So I think at that point he was recruited. It could have been through naval intelligence, but in the end, he was a CIA asset, and a CIA. I call him an intelligence agent, but lower level. I mean, he wasn't at a very high level. He probably wanted to go to a higher level, but they used and abused him. And he was good. He was good at spycraft. When people always talk about, wow, Oswald had all these cameras, and he had all these really small spy cameras that people found. And that was part of what he did. He was really good at photography, and he was really good at spy photography, right? And using these really small cameras to take photos of whatever he needed to take photos of. So he was a patriot, liked Kennedy, was loved kids. Really loved kids. There's some stories in the book that people tell me about. They knew him during that time. Not only, obviously, he loved his two daughters, obviously, that he had with Marina, but he was also just really listened to kids. And back then, in the 50s and early 60s, adults didn't listen to kids. They were to be seen and not heard. But a guy like Oswald just would talk to him, and pay attention to them when they spoke. So you get a different glimpse of this guy than what the official narrative wants you to believe.
Right. Like the communist sympathizer. It really is remarkable. And it's taken a long time to change a lot of those perspectives that were hammered into people in the 60s. But one of the interesting aspects of your book, which you don't see in a lot of, if any, kind of JFK investigation books, is you talk to people who were family members of the CIA. One name that pops up, I don't know who Channa Willis is, but I know St. John Hunt, Peter Janney, and Milligan. But maybe you can talk about their insights and perspective into killing Kennedy.
Yeah, that was also fascinating an important part of the book, because here you have four people who I interviewed whose fathers were all in the CIA during that time period. You have Peter Janney, whose father was Wister Janney, who was incredibly high up in the CIA at the time. And, you know, you have to realize all these people also all knew each other because they all lived in the DC, Maryland area. They were all basically elite blue bloods, Ivy League educated. And so this is the way things were done. Alan Dulles, when he was the director of the CIA, he recruited.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Not exclusively, but he almost exclusively from places like Harvard and Yale. And he wanted these blue bloods, because he almost had to have, there's an elitism that I found existed and still exists to this day and has always existed. And this idea that I'm born into a family and I am meant to rule over the masses. And this is the mindset that they wanted because of the things they were doing. They thought that it was for the best for the country, that they ruled over and controlled everyone else in the country. And that was the attitude that the CIA had and some of these other agencies where they recruited these types of people who had that attitude. So for them to say, well, listen, we don't like Kennedy, we got to get rid of him. Because of what Kennedy was trying to change all that. And Kennedy probably didn't think that they would have the gall to do it, which is why he was in an open car that day with no roof. I think he didn't realize how far these people would go to maintain their power and control.
Yeah, it is remarkable. And they all hung out to each other. They knew each other's kids. And the drinking, too, was an important component of kind of their worldview. Like, they're just,
swimming
in alcohol, yeah.
It was almost collateral damage, because they're doing things that are so nefarious on a daily basis and affecting other people's lives in a negative way. And what I mean by this is, let's say, the coup in Guatemala in the late 50s. Well, hundreds of thousands of Guatemalans died because of that coup. Well, that was the CIA. And the reason they did that was because of the United Fruit Company. And Alan Dulles and his brother John Foster Dulles had tons of stock in the United Fruit Company. And the United Fruit Company, of course, was a CIA front as well. And we did a lot of, because the United Fruit Company was all over the world, and especially Central and South America. So again, it's these horrible things. And you think at first you're a patriot, right? I'm a patriot. So I'm a cold warrior and I'm doing what's best for the country. But over time, it starts to wear on you. And that was interesting about interviewing these kids of these families, right? And they're adults now, but at the time they were children. They saw it. They saw the damage it did to their fathers were all a lot, for the most part, raging alcoholics. The moms became same way because they had to deal with the husbands, you know, and then the kids were, they might have had nannies and a bunch of money, but there was no connection to the fathers. And you see this with St. John Hunt. You know, God bless that guy. I mean, he's such a nice guy, St. John Hunt, but he's been damaged his whole life because his father was E. Howard Hunt, period.
Right. I mean, he was involved in so many different things, pigs, Watergate. I mean, it's a tough legacy to have. And especially like Janney, like you're reading through Janney's story and he has more connection to his African-American nanny than his parents in some ways. Like he mentions her as like a huge influence. So a lot of these people were burdened. You talk about Wisner kills himself because of all this stuff. But I think that even Angleton went into alcohol rehab too. And Janney, his dad died at 59, fairly young.
Yeah, that's young.
You know, the damage. So they carried a real heavy burden. Even the people who, you know, we're doing these, you know, the head of the American Pax Americana, American Empire, so to speak. Yeah. Who is Chana Willis? Like, I haven't heard her name. Can you explain her and her importance and her family's connection to the Kennedy assassination?
Yeah, she came out fairly, I would say fairly recently with her story, and she held on to it for a while. Her father was in the CIA. He was Naval Intelligence. He was in the Navy. During World War II, for most of these guys, that was the path, right? So they were in World War II, they were in the Navy, they were wherever, and one thing led to another. Patriot, true patriot. And he found himself, her father was a, expert. He did photography. He was an expert at that as well. Not, I would say more so than Oswald, but he used to, they used to get the U-2 spy planes and any photography that they got, he would make sure it was developed and analyzed. And, you know, whether it was from, you know, it could have been from airplanes, mostly it was from the air. And you know, whether it was, you know, trying to determine if the Russians had missiles in Cuba, et cetera. So he was, and then what happened was they transferred him to Dallas, and maybe 3 months before the assassination, I can't remember exactly, but it wasn't long before, too long before. And they gave him this assignment, and Chana, being his daughter, was just one of those headstrong people who kept bugging her dad until the day he passed away. And it was like, "Dad, what happened? Tell me." And her dad would get so upset and then be worried about her, you know, for asking. And then, you know, and little by little, she told him these things. And she said that he was told that on November 22nd, 1963, he was part of a photo surveillance team, if you will. And he says that one of the members of his team was Lee Harvey Oswald, and that because Oswald was good with that stuff. And they were all told that this is what they needed to do. It's need to know, right? So you do this, you do this. On November 22nd, you're here. Oswald, you're in this Texas school book depository. They told Chana's dad, they said, "You're going to be by the grassy knoll and you're going to be taking, filming something." It wasn't sure what. And she remembers that when they went to visit the grassy knoll years later, and then went to visit Dealey Plaza, the dad stood up in the grassy knoll by the fence and just stared off, like had a 1,000-yard stare. And she's like, "Dad, are you all right?" And he couldn't even talk. He couldn't talk about it. So it's basically that she surmised from that anyway, that he was there that day and he probably saw things that he shouldn't. I shouldn't say shouldn't have seen. He was meant to see, but they were so scared. He said that shortly before November 22nd, they actually started to realize what was actually going to happen that day, or could happen that day. And they all wanted out. But what he said is that the CIA threatened all of them and their families. They say, "You're going to go through with this. This is your job. This is what you do. You just show up and do what you're supposed to do." Wow. And he said one of the guys actually committed suicide because he couldn't deal with what was going to happen. But who was the guy? One of the guys on his team was Oswald. And he told Chana, he said, "I could tell you that Lee Harvey Oswald did not shoot a gun that day because he was part of my team And my team was just supposed to be in different areas. I was supposed to give film to someone else here, and they were supposed to take it from the school depository to this place and da da da. So you had a lot of people in Dealey Plaza that day that had assignments, but they didn't know that there was even going to be assassination. They only knew what they were supposed to do.
Right. So it was all compartmentalized. Wow. Incredible.
Totally.
And a lot of those people, like, that's the feeling that you see through this. People, you ask really good questions about what the consequences of Kennedy's death. A lot of people keyed into that, but there's a pervasive sense of fear in a lot of these stories. And a researcher who just unfortunately passed away, Richard Belzer, wrote a book on a lot of people who were murdered. It was hit list, right? So he keyed into that aspect of the story of this kind of, like, you could get assassinated. You could end up like Mary Pinchot Meyer or some of these other unfortunates. Even reverberated to Robert F. Kennedy probably too, is that it was attached to his brother's death. So really kind of terrifying stuff. I mean, there's a lot more to this book. What's the story of the two little girls? I don't know that story. Can you talk about that?
So yeah, I was fortunate enough to interview two different girls who were both, this is ironic, but they were both 9 years old the day of the assassination. And they were both in Dallas that day. One is known as the girl in blue because she's actually standing on one of those concrete slabs, and you can see her in some of the footage of the parade when Kennedy's motorcade comes by. She's there, and she was wearing a blue dress because she wanted Kennedy to notice her. And what's amazing about her story is that she had some family issues with her family. And here's this 9-year-old girl who wanted acceptance. And to her, all she wanted was for John Kennedy and or Jackie Kennedy to look at her and acknowledge her. So they do. And she says, I know they did. They did for a split second. And she's the happiest little girl in the world. And then they make that turn. And then 5 seconds later, she's still watching as it's the limo's going away, moving away from her. And all of a sudden she hears what she thought were fireworks. And then she saw this pink spray in and around the car. And that was Kennedy's head being blown off, basically. And she said she went from the happiest girl in the world to traumatized girl, and it affected her for the rest of her life. And again, I wanted these stories in there because, listen, it might have happened 60 years ago, but this was such a seminal event in our history that it still matters so much. And it matters for political reasons, but it also matters for personal reasons, for, you know, and for the people who were there. You know, first of all, they're amazing stories. And the other girl, also 9 years old, which I found even more interesting as it relates to Oswald, because her grandmother owned the boarding house that Oswald stayed in. So she's 9 years old. Her brothers are, I want to say that she has two brothers and they're all around the same age. And they all would go after school. They would go to her grandmother's boarding house so the grandmother could watch them because the mom was working. So they would get to know some of the people who stayed there. Lee Harvey Oswald was one of the only people they really got to know because he was so friendly to them. She tells two specific stories that I have to tell real quick because it says a lot. It says an awful lot. One is that she also was dyslexic. Pat Hall is her name. And so her grandmother was a headstrong woman. She owned this boarding house and she's like, you know, she wanted her to do well in school. So she'd be studying and doing her homework at her grandmother's house after school. And the grandmother would get frustrated with her. It's like, why can't you understand what you're reading, etc. And Lee Harvey Oswald, there were times that he would just pass by and say, go like this to her and whisper in her ear and say, never give up. He knew what the problem was and he had the same problem. And he didn't want to interfere with the grandmother, but he wanted her to know, is it going to be okay? Never give up. And the other story is one day, the two brothers were boys, typical boys. They wanted to play and do whatever. And Lee would play with them. Whatever they wanted to do, Lee would do. If they wanted to do Cowboys and Indians, he'd play Cowboys and Indians. If they wanted to, whatever it is. So they're on the front lawn and they're playing and the brothers started to wrestle and they got into a bit of a real fight. So Lee took both of them and sat them on the porch, the front porch. Pat Hall happened to be there right by the front door, by the doorway. So he heard the whole thing. He sat them down and basically told them, he said, "You guys are brothers and you have to love each other your whole lives. You have to be there for each other and you have to love each other. You can't be fighting." Okay. And he like sat them down and told them this, that gave them this incredible, wasn't even a lecture. It was just basically telling them how important it was that they were brothers and that they loved each other. And it blew this young Pat Hall away. She's like, wow. When everything went down weeks later, the family was in shock. The brothers, Pat says to this day, really haven't recovered. I mean, here was this guy, Lee, Mr. Lee, they called him Mr. Lee. He was so nice and friendly to them. And all of a sudden he's, you know, arrested for killing the president. And then 2 days later on live TV, he's shot and they're watching this as a family. It was absolutely devastating, but I was honored to tell these stories because those stories need to be told.
Right. Just so many people were traumatized by that. People who've looked into it, people who've learned the real story. I mean, it's pretty clear that he was right when he said, "I'm a patsy." He probably just realized it too late that he was getting set up for it, which is really unfortunate. I mean, what else is in the book? Like, you talked to some of the greats, Peter Dale Scott, Jefferson Morley. I've talked to him 4 or 5 times. I mean, and maybe you can talk about what else is in the book, but also, what do you think the reverberating impact is on these families and the country from this event, killing Kennedy?
Well, what I would say is that in 1963, there was this ideology known as American exceptionalism. And basically it was an American way of life that personified liberty and freedom, right? We were the best in the world at that time. We were the heroes of World War II. We had a strong economy. People could work and earn a decent living and buy a house and have a family. Everything. We were the good guys. We wore the white hats. After Kennedy was killed, that sense of American exceptionalism began to erode, and it has eroded continuously for 60 years. And it started immediately because people realized that they really couldn't trust the institutions that they thought they could trust. Because even though people, you know, the Warren Commission report came out, it's like, okay, this is it. It was Oswald. That's it. So many people, even first of all, didn't believe that. But even the ones who did believe it, and this is another part of the book that I get when I get into this, there's a psychological aspect to it where it's called cognitive dissonance. So it's the idea that it's so upsetting for a person to believe, to think that their government would do something like this, that they refuse to believe it. That's cognitive dissonance. It makes you feel so uncomfortable. You don't want to go there. So you're like, oh, okay. I believe Walter Cronkite. I believe Dan Rather. I believe the Warren Commission. That's it. Cause I can't handle psychologically the other alternative. So I think subconsciously, I think most Americans knew that there was something horribly wrong about what happened that day. And it wasn't Lee Harvey Oswald, this lone nut communist sympathizer that, you know, killed Kennedy, that was not what happened. And it has caused issues in this country ever since. So that the lasting ripple effect, the major from a big picture view is that everything's changed and everything has gotten progressively worse since then in a lot of ways, especially with government. And I don't know if we could truly heal unless the truth comes out about that. I don't know if it will. So that that's the answer to that question. But you mentioned a couple people. One section of the book is the deep state, the fourth estate and the deep state. And it's the idea when I spoke to these people, obviously Peter Dale Scott talks about the deep state, and he is world-renowned scholar. I was so lucky to be able to interview him because he's not a young man.
When I was at Berkeley, I would walk by Sather Gate with him. Back, I mean, this is like so long ago.
Wow. Like
25 years ago. Yeah, but I used to read this. There was like a rudimentary website called Deep State, and it had this funny flame things. But that's where you had to find the actual real information. But yeah, even back then, I remember seeing him. He still kind of looks the same. He looks like kind of gray hair, but
he's amazing.
Interesting thing. Yeah, amazing guy.
A true scholar in every sense of the word. I mean, he's written more than I'll ever write in my lifetime. But and again, it would be very enlightening. And talking about, you know, to Jefferson Morley and Donald Jeffries, to try to talk to them about the Fourth Estate, the media, and how the mass media, the U.S. media, failed horribly, failed us horribly when it came to the Kennedy assassination. But what people don't realize is that there was something known as Operation Mockingbird. And Operation Mockingbird was a CIA operation, started it during the Cold War. And the whole goal of it was to infiltrate the mainstream media and control the narrative. It was propaganda. So, you know, the CIA and anything we were doing, we had to be the good guys against communism, and people needed to get on board with that. And the mainstream media needed to get on board with that. So they infiltrated all these the media, you know, New York Times, Washington Post, thousands of others. And they basically ran and said whatever the CIA told them to. So when they were telling them that, oh, the Warren Commission is right and, you know, blah, 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 and that Jack Ruby, you know, shot Oswald because he didn't want Jacqueline Kennedy to have to endure a trial. That is the most absurd thing I've ever heard in my life. I have to say it. And people bought that. Not everyone. You know, I think if you're a critical thinker, you're not buying that, because that I tell people that alone should tell you that there was a conspiracy, a real conspiracy. Because that's absurd, as is the magic bullet theory. I mean, those two things alone are the most, again, as a rational, critical thinker, there is no way you can accept that as fact.
And I think Mockingbird was run by Cord Meyer Jr. I think he was a critical component. So you have this guy involved in the Mockingbird, whose wife eventually gets killed, who's a paramour of Kennedy. It's just an incredible era. It's hard to believe. What really, I mean, the real facts are even more amazing than the story they put around the Kennedy assassination. But yeah, great book. I mean, I think that it's really fascinating to see how similar the perspectives are on these varied people, how they keyed into the real change in the country and the impact even to this day. Like you said, 60 years from now, these people still say it's very important, this whole event, understanding this event is very important for us as a people and a country. I think it's, I think you did a superb job. So congrats on the book. Is there anything you'd like to add or anything I missed? I mean, we're at the 40-minute mark here, Jack. Anything you'd like to add?
You know, I would just tell people, listen, my goal in writing this book was to create a book that was compelling, well-written, easy to read. That's why I set the book up the way I did. You know, that each chapter is an interview. And I wanted, read it, but don't listen to me. Certainly I'm doing the interviewing, so I'm not really coming to any conclusions. I'm just presenting the information. But, and don't listen, don't even, if you don't want it, don't listen to the people in the book. Do your own research. But please be a critical thinker. Open your mind, be a free thinker, and understand that the Kennedy assassination is not what the official narrative has been saying it is. It's not. I think, again, as critical thinkers, we all know that this is the case. We all know we were lied to. Will we ever know who was standing behind the grassy knoll doing the shooting that day, or where exactly they did the shooting from, or how many shooters there were? Probably never. Never. But if we continue to be critical about it and continue to demand the truth and trying to get new documents and pushing, I think that's the only way we can heal as a country, because we've never, I think the Kennedy assassination has been like a black cloud over us since. I really believe that. And you look at all the presidents we've had since. It's just Kennedy was our, it was Camelot. It was our last best chance for world peace to truly be great, a great nation with great people. And that was all taken away from us. And all I want to do is with this book is put it out there and have people, you know, read it, draw your own conclusions, but please keep an open mind.
And where's the best place to get it? I know it's on Amazon. Are people able to order a signed copy from your website?
Not a signed copy, that they can order it from my website. It's jackrothauthor.com, because they're all coming from the Skyhorse Warehouse, which is where it's being printed. So the publisher. So, but Amazon certainly is the easiest place to get it. But if you go to my website, you can find out a little more about it. And there's also links to like Barnes & Noble and other retailers where you can get it.
Gotcha. And that's Jack Roth Author, all one word, .com. So people can check that out. If you're watching this on Rockfin, you can see the website. And is that the best place to contact you, Jack, as well?
Yeah, yes. You can email me from there. I've gotten emails from people who've either ordered the book or read it. And I appreciate those. I appreciate people caring, right? And then I love chatting with people, and because I know they care. So if they care enough to get with me, I care enough to get back with them.
Cool. So people can contact you through that. And it's actually, I mean, I can see the stats on my show, and people are still fascinated with the JFK event. I mean, just by listenership. So most of my, you know, those shows that I've done in the past with other investigators have all been some of my most listened to podcasts. But thanks so much for your time, Jack. Again, title of the book is Killing Kennedy, Exposing the Plot, the Cover-Up, and the Consequences. And the author is Jack Roth again. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, William. Thanks for having me. I had a lot of fun.
All right, cheers. Likewise. Stay there.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.